Welcome and thank you for joining us for another episode of KPMG's Inside International Tax, a podcast devoted to recent developments, observations, and trends related to U.S. international tax. I'm one of your hosts, Gary Scanlon, a principal in KPMG's WNT International Tax Practice. I'm joined by my co-host, Kristen Gamboa, a managing director in the same group. Hey, Kristen.
Hey, Gary.
So today marks a special milestone for us. It's our 50th episode. It's a minor miracle that KPMG's leadership let us get past the first episode. We wanted to thank our listeners for the support, and here's to many more episodes to come. So on January 14th, 2025, Treasury and the IRS published long-awaited final regs addressing the characterization of digital content and cloud transactions, and the sourcing for certain digital transactions. Along with these final regulations, the government separately issued proposed regs that would provide guidance on the source of income from cloud transactions. These regulations come nearly 6 years after Treasury and the IRS proposed regulations in 2019, aimed to bring the rules for characterizing computer and other digital transactions into the modern age, where the term floppy disk elicits little to no response except perhaps laughter. So this has been a long time coming. For today's discussion, we're joined again by Matt McNeil, a principal in KPMG's value chain management practice. We're also speaking to David DeRoog and first-time guest Marissa Renson, both managing directors in KPMG's WNT International Tax Practice. Hi, all.
Hey, Gary. Good to be with you.
Hi, Gary. Hi, Kristen. Thanks for having me back.
Hi, Gary. Thanks for having me here.
So before we dive into the details of the 2025 regulations, it's probably helpful to start with some background on the rules for characterizing certain transactions involving digital content and cloud transactions and the history of these rules. As we'll discuss in more depth shortly, characterization of a transaction for U.S. tax purposes is often critical in determining the U.S. tax consequences of that transaction, including a taxpayer's withholding tax obligations and the capacity to claim credits for foreign taxes paid. The first set of rules addressing the characterization of transactions involving computer programs were issued back in 1998, and these are commonly referred to as the software regulations. Under the software regulations, transactions involving computer programs were treated as one of four categories of transactions, and depending on the category, were then characterized as a sale, lease, license, or the provision of services. However, the software regulations only apply to transactions involving computer programs, which didn't include common transactions like the provision of digital content. Recognizing that the software regulations needed to be modernized, Treasury issued the 2019 proposed regulations, which consisted of two parts. The first part would have expanded the scope of the rules to apply to transfers of digital content, but would have largely kept the same framework. The second part would have introduced rules specifically for characterizing transactions that involve cloud computing and other on-demand network access to digital resources or other kinds of transactions that weren't already covered by the software regulations. While the 2025 regulations broadly follow the 2019 proposed regs, there are a couple of key changes. And as Gary mentioned, there are brand new proposed sourcing rules for cloud transactions, all of which we'll get into on today's episode.
Before we get into all these changes, I think it's really helpful to step back and ask why we care about these rules. So as an initial matter, Marissa, why should our listeners care about the characterization of digital or cloud transactions?
The way that a transaction is characterized can have significant tax impacts. Just to take a simple example, if a consumer pays a subscription fee for online access to a software program, it's probably treated as a service. Under the general rule for sourcing services income, the provider's income will be sourced based on where the provider is providing the services from. So if a U.S.-based company provides a software service and the service is treated as being performed in the United States, that U.S. company would have U.S.-sourced income even if some or all of its customers are accessing the software from foreign countries. Now, if a foreign country imposes a withholding tax on that income, something that is becoming more common, particularly in Latin America, that U.S. service provider wouldn't be able to take a foreign tax credit for the tax unless it had some other source of foreign source income in the same category.
That's certainly suboptimal. Would the treatment be different if the customer could, for instance, download the software instead of just accessing it online?
Yes, that would make a big difference. Sticking with our example, let's assume that a foreign customer pays for the right to use the same software for a year, and the customer can download the software and use it offline. That would likely be treated as a rental. Under the general rule for licenses and rentals, income is sourced based on the place of use of the property. So in our example, where the customer is using the software outside the United States, our U.S.-based company's income would be foreign source income, which would increase its capacity to claim foreign tax credits against any foreign taxes imposed on its income.
So these rules would obviously be important for companies that develop their own software, but what about U.S. companies that pay for software developed by foreign providers? Do they have to worry about the characterization of the software transaction?
Yes, it's important for them too. The characterization also impacts withholding tax obligations on U.S. companies that are making payments to foreign companies. So if we assume a U.S. company is paying a foreign company for software services that are performed outside the United States, in that case, the U.S. person would not have any withholding obligation. Withholding obligations generally would only apply to U.S. source income. But if our same company is obtaining access to the same software program from the same foreign company, but now our transaction is structured as a rental, then the U.S. company would have withholding tax obligation unless a treaty applies and exempts that income from withholding tax. This can also have an impact on how foreign corporations' income is taxed if it's a controlled foreign corporation. So whether a CFC's income is taxable under their Subpart F regime or the GILTI regime would depend on the character of the income and which rules apply.
Thanks, Marissa. That's helpful background. So now let's jump into the 2025 final and proposed regs. When are these rules effective?
So the final regulations are prospective. They're applicable for taxable years beginning on or after January 14, 2025. So that means for calendar year taxpayers, the regs are not applicable until the 2026 taxable year. However, there is an option to early adopt the regulations for taxable years beginning on or after August 14, 2019, which is when those 2019 proposed regulations were issued. And there are some pretty substantial consistency requirements for companies who are considering that option. Now, the proposed regulations for sourcing cloud transactions are also prospective, but those are proposed to apply to taxable years beginning on or after the date of finalization, so probably a couple of years out. And there's no reliance or early adoption language.
So there's a lot to unpack in these regulations. Let's start with the final regulations for characterizing digital content and cloud transactions. First of all, David, do we think that the final regulations will change how any existing transactions are characterized?
Thanks, Kristen. As you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, these regulations largely retain the overall approach of the 2019 proposed regulations. There are a couple of helpful simplifications, which we'll describe in a moment, but for the most part, these are somewhat consistent with how taxpayers had previously been classifying transactions. The final regulations under Dash 18 that deal with digital content expanded the scope of those rules to cover more types of copyrighted material other than software programs. So, for example, those rules now include books, movies, and music in digital format, but they didn't change the basic characterization of transactions that are under Dash 18, whether the transaction is a sale or a license or a lease or a service for U.S. tax purposes. When we're talking about the final regulations under Dash 19 that deal with cloud transactions, the final regulations treat all cloud transactions as services transactions. So this is a really helpful simplification. If you're basically satisfying the definition of a cloud transaction, then under the final regulations, you're treated as a service. As under the 2019 proposed regulations, the cloud transaction was generally defined as a transaction through which a person obtained on-demand network access to computer hardware, digital content, or similar resources. Again, under the 2019 proposed version, cloud transactions could be characterized as either a service or a lease, as in the case of leases of computer hardware. The final regulations under Dash 19 helpfully eliminated the facts and circumstances factor approach, which had a number of factors that were similar to Section 7701E that told us, do we have a lease or a service? I kind of think of it this way. Treasury put out a test to help taxpayers determine how to identify a horse or a unicorn. everybody was seeing a horse, the cloud transaction, and not a unicorn, a rental transaction. So the final regulations just did away with the multi-factor test. And as I said, if the transaction meets the definition of a cloud transaction, it's essentially treated as a service.
So that makes sense. Were there any other changes in the final regulations that could impact how digital or cloud transactions are characterized?
So aside from modernizing the software regulations in Dash 18 more generally, the final digital content regulations, as well as the final regulations under Dash 19 dealing with cloud transactions, would provide a simplified test for determining the character of a digital content or cloud transaction via the adoption of a predominant character rule. So it's helpful to understand how this rule would apply by kind of comparing it to the proposed regulations that we received in 2019 and the approach that was proposed there. So in the prior approach, there was a separate characterization of each category of a transaction. So if we're talking about Dash 18, where we might have a transaction that has a component that's a transfer of a copyright right, for example, some underlying aspects of the source code are being transferred, or a copyrighted article where there's a transfer of the actual software that is purchased by a customer and user, we would be required to separately classify each of those transactions unless one of those components was de minimis. Under the final regs, however, if we have a transaction that has multiple elements and one of those elements is a transaction that's described in Dash 18 or a cloud transaction in Dash 19, then we don't have to go through this whole determination of whether one of those elements is de minimis. Instead, we characterize the transaction in its entirety based on the predominant character of the transaction. So the question is, well, how do we know what the predominant character of the transaction is? So the test that's laid out in the final regulations under Dash 18 and applies also for cloud transactions is by looking to determine what the primary benefit or value is to the customer in the particular transaction. That's what I like to refer to as the general rule. However, if we don't have the information to tell us what the primary benefit or value to our customer is in a particular transaction, then we would have to look to how a typical customer benefits or uses the software or the cloud transaction at issue. If that information isn't available, then we can look to a number of factors that indicate the primary benefit or value. So, for example, the regulations tell us to look at how the transaction is marketed, how we spend money on development, what the relative prices are paid in uncontrolled transactions, and then we can determine what the predominant character is of the transaction. Helpfully, the rules don't tell us to go out and create any kind of information that is not already maintained in the business's ordinary course. But again, companies will have to consider the data that they have that tells them how customers are primarily using or benefiting from the transaction.
So it seems like this new approach simplifies the process of characterizing transactions. How would this rule make a practical difference for, let's say, a company that provides access to online software through a downloaded app?
Under the proposed version of the regulations that we received in 2019, those rules would have required us to consider whether any aspect of the transaction between the online component and the download of the app, for example, was de minimis, in which case bifurcation would not be required. However, if neither component was de minimis, then each aspect would have to have been analyzed separately. For example, in the case where the online access added little functionality or wasn't as important, that aspect of the transaction would likely have been treated as de minimis. The transaction would probably be characterized as a transfer property under Dash 18 in its entirety unless the app component was not de minimis in the overall context of the arrangement. By contrast, if access to the online software via the app was necessary to access the full functionality of the app, for example, there are features online that enhance use of the software, then the download would have been viewed as de minimis and not separately classified. And in that case, the transaction would have been classified in its entirety as a service. Now, taxpayers don't have to undertake that analysis to determine what element or aspect of a transaction is de minimis in the overall scheme of things. In many cases, this will just be a simpler analysis for companies to establish the predominant character of the transaction than to establish that all the ancillary rights provided in a transaction are somehow considered de minimis.
You mentioned that the predominant character rule applies on a transaction-by-transaction basis. Do the new rules define what constitutes a transaction?
That's a really good question. In the regulations that we receive, the final regulations, there is no definition of transaction. There is some commentary in the preamble that tells taxpayers to consider general tax principles. But the examples themselves that we receive help us understand some of the contours of what it might mean to have a transaction. For example, you might consider a streaming service which permits temporary downloads. For example, shows downloaded and available without internet access. If you're on a plane, you might be able to download a show or a movie. But then there's an option to buy or rent a specific title. In that case, given the separate consideration paid, one would generally consider these to be two separate transactions. The examples themselves also provide or assume that there are separate transactions when there is, for example, a free option with advertisements on the one hand and a subscription option on the other hand. Or if you can download a game for a fee, but there are separate payments like a subscription arrangement for online access, an additional functionality like multiplayer version of a game, or the customer can purchase additional items for use in a game that are only available when connected to the internet, one would think that those are probably separate transactions as the examples seem to assume.
Could the predominant character rule lead to changes in how taxpayers structure their transactions involving digital content and cloud services? Does it open up any specific opportunities here?
This raises the question of how taxpayers are viewing transactions that have multiple elements or multiple components and whether there are transactions that are bundles. Taxpayers will want to go back and reevaluate some of the commercial aspects of their offerings, perhaps maybe looking at the payment arrangements. If a transaction consists of digital content and cloud transactions, the predominant character rule may result in treating the entire transaction as a cloud transaction and therefore a provision of services or vice versa. So taxpayers may consider going back to look at the commercial arrangements to determine the scope of a transaction with their affiliates or third parties and to see how the predominant character rules would apply going forward.
So now that we've covered how to characterize these transactions, let's shift gears to discuss how digital transactions are sourced under the final regulations. Marissa, can you remind us what the 2019 proposed rules said about how to source digital transactions?
Sure. The prior version of the regulations only addressed the character of transactions involving computer programs. To determine the source of these transactions, the prior regulations just cross-referenced the regular sourcing rules. However, the proposed regulations issued in 2019 provide a special rule for sourcing sales of digital content that are made through an electronic medium, such as a download. So just stepping back a minute, generally, sales of inventory that a taxpayer makes itself are sourced based on where the inventory is produced. And the new rules don't impact that general rule at all. On the other hand, inventory that's purchased and resold is sourced based on where the inventory is sold. So the proposed regulations included a special rule for determining the location of a sale of a copyrighted article, like a computer program, that's transferred electronically. The regulations would deem the sale to occur at the location of the download or installation onto the end user's device.
So, David, are there any limitations to this rule?
Yes, Kristen, there is an anti-abuse rule that can apply in the context of this special sourcing rule for sales of copyrighted articles. So let's take, for example, if the transaction is arranged for tax avoidance purposes, the sale would not be sourced based on the purchaser's billing address. But then again, we would look to the facts and circumstances of the transaction or arrangement. There are a couple examples in the final regulations that demonstrate how this anti-abuse rule would apply and the scope of it. In one example, the use of a bona fide foreign procurement company that buys software for resale within a group is not treated as a tax avoidance purpose. That is important because in that example, the procurement company does not use the software itself. But because the company regularly serves as a procurement hub, then the example concludes that there is no principal purpose of tax avoidance. There's another example, however, where there is a sale to a foreign entity within a multinational structure. That company does not serve as a procurement hub, so the facts and circumstances are taken into account, and the regulation says to look to where the software is used, the place where the negotiation execution of the agreement occurs, and so on and so forth. As mentioned, this rule only applies for purposes of sourcing sales of purchased inventory, so it doesn't apply to income from the sale of inventory that the taxpayer produces itself.
So we've talked a lot about the new final regulations. Let's now switch gears and talk about the new 2025 proposed sourcing rule for cloud services. Before we get into these proposed rules, why do we need special rules for cloud services in the first place?
So stepping back again, the code provides that income from services is sourced based on the place of performance, as we mentioned earlier. Now, our current regulations provide guidance on how to apply this rule to personal services, and they work pretty well for labor-intensive services. For example, a company's got pretty comfortable determining the source of a service based on the personnel hours spent in the United States versus in foreign countries. Those rules don't work quite as well for cloud services, where the primary benefit of the service is access to software or computer hardware rather than to human labor providing the service in real time. So there's case law supporting the idea that we can also location of tangible property in addition to people to determine where the service is provided, but that concept was never incorporated into the regulations.
Thanks, Marissa. So what's different about these new proposed sourcing rules, and how do they propose to source income from cloud transactions?
So the proposed regulations take a formulaic approach based on three factors. So the first factor is the location of the personnel performing core activities related to the provision of a cloud service. The second factor is the location of personnel responsible for developing or obtaining intangible property. And the third factor is the location of tangible assets owned or leased by the taxpayer that are used in the provision of cloud services. So each of these factors is weighted by the taxpayer's expenses, or in the case of property, the taxpayer's amortization or depreciation deductions. Then after all those expenses or deductions are calculated, they go into the denominator of a fraction. And then at a high level, the numerator of that fraction is a portion of all of those expenses that relate to employees or assets in the United States. Then that fraction is multiplied by the taxpayer's income from cloud transactions, and that's the portion of the taxpayer's income that's treated as U.S. source income.
It sounds like a lot of math. So when calculating these factors, what expenses do we use? Is it just amounts paid to the taxpayer's employees, or do expenses related to payments to subcontractors count too?
So generally, this calculation is done on a taxpayer-by-taxpayer basis and just looking at the amounts paid to employees of the taxpayer and any deductions for equipment owned or leased by the taxpayer. However, the treatment of IP is a little different. So the source of the IP factor is just based on the location of the taxpayer's R&D employees that are associated with the cloud transaction. However, the weighting of that IP factor, it takes on a lot of additional expenses. So just for purposes of determining how much weight to give to the IP factor takes into account all of the R&D spend on cloud services, and that includes spend for R&D performed by service providers. It also takes into account amortization of acquired IP and royalty payments to the extent that the IP relates to cloud services. So put another way, the size of the IP factor is determined based on total spend on IP, both for the taxpayer's own employees and subcontractors. But the source of the IP factor is based only on the location of direct employees of the taxpayer. So because of all of this, software developers are likely to have an outsized IP factor relative to the other factors in the equation, putting a lot of pressure on the location of the taxpayer's R&D employees. Now, Matt, I know that this is a pretty big deal for some of the companies that you work with.
Many, if not most, of our clients are accessing global IT talent when developing cloud offerings, whether for sale to third parties or for internal delivery. As we all know, Eastern Europe, South Asia, and of course, Silicon Valley are all global software development talent hubs, but companies often have software development talent in many more countries. Of course, one of the major issues these companies' tax departments manage is to prevent CFCs within the group from generating U.S. source income. Of course, there's scenarios where that might be desirable, but by and large, companies are trying to avoid the FTC limitation impacts of U.S. source income in the hands of their CFCs. A sourcing rule that would result in an allocation of any particular entity's income based upon the global software development footprint for the whole multinational group would have been a big change and could create major FTC limit issues. So companies have to be generally pleased with the direction of travel under the IP factor to source the income of any entity based on the location of only its employees. Now, with branch structures, you may still have U.S. sourcing under the IP factor, but this is typically something companies can manage proactively.
Thanks, Matt. The overall logic of this rule makes some sense, but does this sort of formulaic approach really work for all of the different cloud fact patterns that you're seeing?
There are some quirky fact patterns where the proposed rules leave some questions open. So for one example, some taxpayers may have a significant IP factor because they bought or licensed IP, but they may have no way to source that factor because they don't have any R&D employees whose predominant job it is to work on cloud projects. So we expect the government to address these fact patterns where there's some gaps in the rules, but we do encourage companies to submit comments and talk to the government if they have any particular concerns.
In light of the changes to the final rules, what are some of the practical implications of the regulations for some common business models?
When I'm working with our clients, we are usually focused on three big buckets of digital technology: customer-facing products or platforms, data and data-related digital assets, or internal use software. You might recall that identifying these digital assets can be a bit of a treasure hunt, as I was referring to on our last podcast together. Identifying and then exploiting these different types of digital IP within an organization, that's really the focus of a lot of what we're helping companies with these days. When it comes to exploitation, a company's operating model matters. Let's look at a simple example to understand this better. Suppose you've got a U.S. headquartered multinational that makes smart refrigerators. The refrigerators are, of course, made up of hardware, but also include software embedded in them to make them run and do things like detect your sour milk and rotten fruit and order fresh. Wild times.
Well, Matt, I don't know what's in your fridge, but I don't have any sour milk in mine.
Fair enough, Gary. Maybe I just overshared. But let's further suppose the company develops the smart fridge software through a subsidiary in Poland, but manufactures the fridge through a subsidiary in Thailand. How does the software get from the Polish development team to the Thai manufacturer? Not only how does this happen physically, but under what legal arrangement does the software transfer? Both the legal terms as well as the nature of the actual transfer matter for characterization purposes. For example, if the Polish development affiliate transfers the software from a server in Poland to the manufacturer in Thailand and gives the Thai manufacturing affiliate the right to make copies of that software and then embed it into the refrigerators as it's manufacturing and selling those, we'd likely have the transfer of a copyright right as defined in the software regs. And as a result, we'd characterize that transfer as a license generating royalty income. We'd then have to consider the downstream consequences of that. So, for example, this could trigger Thai withholding tax on the royalty paid to Poland. From a U.S. tax perspective, this characterization would impact our subpart F analysis. And then in terms of sourcing this income, we'd look to the rules under sections 861 and 862. Alternatively, the Polish entity could sell unitized copies of the software to be embedded into the devices. In this type of model, the Thai manufacturer would have no right to duplicate the software it acquires from its Polish affiliate, and instead it would be purchasing individualized copies of the software. From an operating model perspective, these might be transferred in bulk or perhaps downloaded directly from the Polish server each time a copy is needed. In a structure like this, we typically view the transfer from Poland to Thailand akin to a third-party shrink-wrap license, similar to how we get software for decades from the large software manufacturers. These type of transactions are typically characterized as the sale of copyrighted articles under the Dash 18 regs. Of course, as a result of this different characterization result, the downstream tax consequences would be different. For example, most countries don't impose withholding tax on the sale of inventory. In addition, with proper substance and software production activity in Poland, the Polish affiliate would not earn subpart F income. And as for sourcing, assuming again that sufficient software production activities are occurring in Poland, its income would be sourced under Section 863 rather than 861 and 862. So you can see that operating model choices can very much result in varying tax implications for a business like the one in our example. As a result, we're spending a lot of time with our clients working through these considerations and designing the operating model appropriately. By and large, the new regs really don't change the result of our analysis here, but they do provide more clarity on issues like whether the transfer of the software, particularly where it's transferred in an electronic medium, will be characterized as the transfer of an IP right or the sale of inventory. As you might imagine, though, as factual scenarios multiply, the complication of the analysis and the impact could be significantly different. For example, let's take our same scenario. But this time, let's assume our company is doing the fridge manufacturing in the U.S. And who knows, we may be seeing a lot more of that happening in the future if President Trump has his way. But in that scenario, a license of the software could be subject to U.S. withholding tax on royalties. Alternatively, if the Polish affiliate sells copyrighted articles to the U.S. manufacturing affiliate, we'd look to its activities and assess whether it's producing the software under the terms of the regs and the associated case law. In this case, there's a risk that if the Polish software developer does not have sufficient substance, that it could fail to be treated as producing the software, in which case its income would not be sourced under 863B to the place of production of that software, that's Poland, and hence foreign source income being generated, but rather under 861 and 862. And with the new billing address rule, that could result in U.S. source income in the hands of the Polish affiliate, a bad answer for foreign tax credit limitation purposes. Similarly, intercompany transactions and relationships aren't always as clean as we're talking about here. There could be multiple types of inventory being sold between the parties, or a mix of inventory and services being sold. In that case, the regs, having made a change with moving to the predominant character analysis rather than bifurcation, certainly impacts how we analyze and structure these types of operating models. In terms of the practical implications of the proposed cloud regs, certainly the simplification of determining whether you have a service transaction is welcome. I think under the prior framework with the SaaS hallmarks, the tax practitioner community generally struggled to come up with scenarios where SaaS wasn't characterized as a service. David, I think you were just referring to this as the unicorn. And so the proposed regulatory framework really resulted in a lot of tax consultant hours spent to document the position that SaaS was in fact a service without really any meaningful variance in outcomes. I also think that the proposed cloud regs give some helpful insight into what the IRS views as delivery of cloud services. The IRS identifies the conduct of scientific, engineering, or technical activities for the configuration, delivery, or maintenance of a cloud transaction, the provision of monitoring, diagnostic, or incident response with respect to cloud transactions, or reliability, efficiency, security-related services. The management of cloud transaction or cloud platforms infrastructure as well is identified as delivery-related activity. And so all of these and similar activities, where we see the IRS pointing to that as delivery of the cloud service, it's really helpful signpost for us, a way to distinguish what really is cloud delivery versus the software development activity. And as we see more and more companies developing and deploying internal cloud platforms and data lakes, really trying to enable greater operational efficiency or more effectively exploit the data they're collecting, distinguishing software development and DEMPI type activities from mere cloud delivery is becoming increasingly important to designing efficient and robust operating models.
Thanks, Matt. That's very helpful. Are the implications any different for companies that aren't making the digital content or providing the cloud service, but are merely reselling it?
Yeah, that's a great question, Gary. The regulations clarify a number of important points here, both in the text as well as some of the examples provided directly on point for resellers of digital content and cloud services. I know we touched on the predominant character rules earlier, but it might be helpful to discuss those here as they could apply in the reseller context as well. Marissa, David, do you want to speak to each of those respectively?
Sure, I can speak to that first. So in many of the cases, a transaction between a content owner and a reseller will have the same characterization as a transaction between the reseller and the ultimate consumer. So the final regulations give a couple of helpful examples of back-to-back sales of copyrighted articles or back-to-back services. In those examples, the reseller is just reselling the same right that it obtains from the content owner, and both legs of the transaction have the same character. So pretty straightforward. However, this isn't always going to be the case. For example, in the SaaS context, the regulations indicate that if it's the reseller that's responsible for hosting the software rather than the content owner, In the first leg of the reseller arrangement, so between the content owner and the reseller, that could be treated as a license to the reseller. Then the second leg, between the reseller and the customer, that could be treated as a service. It's another example that's hinted at in the regulations and the examples. If the arrangement involves downloadable software with a significant online component, the primary benefit to the reseller could be different from the primary benefit to the ultimate consumer.
Right. Then as we think about the application of the predominant character rules in a reseller fact pattern like this, for example, maybe we have a bundle of software and services and those are being transferred. We need to think about how the predominant character of that transaction will influence the ultimate classification. So consideration of each part of the business, the content creator to the taxpayer, and then the taxpayer's delivery of that content to the customer, each would need to be separately taken into consideration. And depending on the predominant character rules, those there could be different revenue streams. One other thing to point out here that is helpful is that there is an example that discusses how these rules would apply in the context of a situation where a taxpayer provides platform or agency services. So in the final regulations, they give an example of a company that provides an online platform which hosts apps for download on a customer's phone. In that example, the transaction between the platform and the app developers has a number of separate elements. But the example concludes that the predominant character of the transaction is that of a platform and agency service, so not a cloud transaction or other digital content transaction. Because under those facts, the primary benefit or value to the app creator is access to the platform.
Thanks. And we need to wrap this episode up. We all have day jobs. Matt, any final thoughts?
Yeah, sure, Gary. If I had one item for the audience here to take away from this discussion, it would be that whether you're playing offense or defense, you really need to get under the hood and to understand what exactly your organization is doing with software, data, and related technologies, for example, AI, and how those technologies are being made available not only to your customers, but internally across your organization. As we talked about the last time we were together, Gary, digital content-related IP is driving an increasing portion of most companies' profit. Getting character and source right for digital content and cloud transactions can have significant implications for both U.S. and foreign tax exposure.
Thank you, Matt, David, and Marissa for your insights on the final and proposed digital content and cloud regulations. And a special thank you to Helena Koval for her help behind the scenes with this episode. We'll definitely continue to monitor the impact of these rules, including the future of the proposed sourcing rule. As always, please stay tuned for future episodes of KPMG's Inside International Tax to stay up to speed on the latest developments in U.S. international tax. Until our next episode, take care.